all civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group Studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necronomapod with your hosts, Mike Stoffel and Mike Moncada, episode 159, Stephen Gilbert's Ratman's Notebook, the story about a man named Ratman who has notebooks, and a rat who loves him, and it's not Ben Michael Jackson, and now Necronomapod.
Help! Something's Hello. Crawling up my leg!
Eek, eek.
Give me cheese! I want cheese!
Hey! So we read a book!
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a little while.
I was reading other books in the summer.
As was I.
Type 2 diabetes. A lot of things get in the way.
Yes, yes. Oh, that old excuse. So, how you been?
Just dandy. Now that the temperature's below 90.
Yes. Oh, dear. That was...
The cool nights. The long shadows.
The long shadows.
The sniff of changing leaves in the air.
The persistent yellow jackets.
Right. The telephone pole almost falling onto my car.
Oh, that's right. And this is the time of the year, that magical time of the year, when vermin from the outdoors start to move inside.
Oh, what have you gotten?
Nothing rats? Yet. No rats. No mice yet either, but this is the time that we start to cure the traps in the middle of the night. Not that, you know, I want to antagonize those creatures, because they, you know, they're smarter than you think.
Mm-hmm. They have revenge on their tiny little souls.
They do. So, hey, we read a kind of an iconic book that nobody has heard of.
Who knew?
Yeah. Somebody did, apparently, but I did not.
They wouldn't have known it as the Ratman's Notebooks, right?
No. No, yes. So this book, The Ratman's Notebooks by Stephen Gilbert, is actually really, really famous because it was made into a movie called Willard, which people of a certain age, I would say from your 50s to your 60s, 65, maybe even 70.
Well, here's the thing, that when it came out, the movie, which was in the early 70s,
1970,
right?
Yeah.
There's no way I could have gotten in to see that movie.
No.
But we knew about it.
We
knew about it, and we were scared of it, even though we had never seen it. It wasn't on TV. You had to go to the movie theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we knew about it.
Yeah. And I did finally see it when it was on TV. It was like, you know, the Friday night movie of the week or something like that in 1973. And it freaked me all the way out.
Wait, on 1973 it was on the TV already?
Yeah. You know, when, you know, networks used to do these, they'd pay a big premium price to do, like, you know, the movie of the week. And they'd have, you know, they'd have the slot on. Maybe it was Sunday nights. Although I thought it was Friday nights.
Movie of the Week was usually a made-for-TV movie.
But they would buy Hollywood things too, and they have this big to-do broadcast. And I remember Willard being one of those and watching it.
Hmm.
And you know how after Jaws, people didn't like go in their swimming pools because they were too freaked out.
Right.
I think Willard had that same effect, smaller, but about basements.
Right. Really? Basements are always creepy. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, for sure.
But yes, it was. And then, of course, then there was the sequel. And then there was that awful Michael Jackson song.
Yeah.
that's also how we knew about this.
Right.
But absolutely. I never knew it was from a book.
Yeah, I didn't either. I just thought it was just something that it was just made into a movie. I mean, it was like a movie made out of whole cloth, out of a screenplay. So I don't really remember much. A whole lot about the movie, but from reading this book, I think it hews pretty closely to the story.
Well, I feel like they changed it from England to Ireland to the United States. Is that true?
Yeah, I think
the movie in the United States.
Yeah, and do you remember who played Jones?
No.
Ernest Borgnine.
No.
Yeah. He was a star. The guy who played Willard is still an actor. He's he gets a lot of work. He usually plays
Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, kind of Nebuchadnezzar. Actually, he plays a lot of generals and people in uniform, or the other lieutenant in the police station. But he gets he does like 3, 4, 5 things a year, and he has been since the 70s.
Okay, I have to go look him up.
Yeah,
but here's what I was reading, and I misread it, and now I'm reading it right.
Mm-hmm.
So this book was written by Stephen Gilbert.
Yeah,
but it's been attributed to another Stephen Gilbert that was the pseudonym of Gilbert Alexander Ralston. And that Stephen Gilbert wrote the screenplay to Willard, but it wasn't the person who wrote this book.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
I wonder if they're being kind of sneaky about that, trying to confuse the rights management people.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
I don't know.
That's awesome.
He wrote Westerns, Ralston guy.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing. So as we were both reading through this book, we both know that it becomes Willard, but Willard is never named. In fact, the Ratman is never named in this book. In fact, few characters actually are given proper names. They're his...
The
two rats, Socrates and Ben Sulayman, Ben for short, Jones, who is given a name that could not be more generic.
Right.
And then there's a family of people that the rat man robs. We hear their last name. And a few other people, but his girlfriend, later his wife, is just called The Girl.
Right.
And there's the bookkeeper and the mother and the father. It's this weirdly anonymous book. It's kind of interesting for that.
Yeah, and why do you think he did that?
I don't know. It has an effect.
What's the effect? Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, the effect is it makes it sort of that it could take place anywhere. Because they don't talk about where this takes place either. It's clearly somewhere in Britain, in Great Britain. Or in the kingdom or in the islands. If he was the author is a Northern Irish, he is part of Great Britain, and not certainly not Ireland, even now. So
the other thing I was reading in the foreword, which was written by Kim Newman, you know how much we love her. That
her pronouns are he, him, his.
He'll always be a she, her, and Herm to me. He wrote that this book is the beginning of the horror kind of nomenclature in the library, the bookstore.
Yeah.
That this started that part. I don't know what you would call it. Label.
The marketing handle.
And it started with this book.
Yeah, it's the normal argument goes that it started when Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist became huge bestsellers, and the publishers and marketers decided that, hey, we should pull books into this new thing. It's like this is the new Exorcist, or this is scarier than Rosemary's Baby, and this has to be among the very first, because right when that was happening, Willard became this big deal movie, and they did a movie edition of it, and that's where they shelved it.
Oh, they did a movie edition, a novelization of the movie.
They took this book and they just put the movie poster on the cover.
Oh, okay. They didn't rewrite the book.
Yeah, they retitled it Willard.
And then Kim also says that Stephen King borrowed from this idea.
I'm curious.
The notebook idea, the kind of the.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like King borrowed more from Dracula than the structure of the notes and the notebook and the different.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stephen King has systematically rewritten every book that he admires. Salem's Lot is rewriting Dracula. The Shining is rewriting Burnt Offerings. Burnt Offerings. Yeah, you ever see that?
Mrs. Allardyce. Mrs. Allardyce.
But it is. Carrie, I don't know what is a rewrite of that.
Oh,
that is.
But we know who borrowed from Carrie, and that was the last book we did was Troop, because he mentions
That
he
absolutely
that it influenced him.
Yeah. I've read, I don't know,
maybe a gazillion,
maybe a quarter of his books.
Oh, King?
Less. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably less. And this isn't coming to mind. I can think of other books that are clearly heavily influenced by this. You know the writer China Mieville?
Yeah, we read her books.
Yeah, we did his Perdido Street Station. His first novel is
called... Oh, it's a he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought it was a she.
Yeah, it's definitely a he. I mean, who knows? You know, who knows? I'm pretty sure
it matters, but sometimes when you're thinking of the author, you're thinking of their gender sometimes. Yeah. I do. And
yeah, no, he's a bald Londoner.
Oh my God.
Avowed weightlifter with a string of hoop earrings all up and down his back.
I completely always thought of somebody like Margaret Cho.
Oh, sure.
Like a really skinny Margaret Cho. I've always pictured, but with pink hair.
Oh my God. When you see a picture of China Mieville, you are going to plots. Because he has no hair. None of it is pink.
Oh my God.
I mean, all of his bald hair might be pink.
That could be other hair could be pink, but very, we don't. But that's very, not in the cover of the jacket.
It's not in his author bio. Anyway. But his first book is called King Rat, which is a retelling of the Pied Piper story, this is too.
Yes, it is.
And I didn't even think about that until I thought about it. It's like, well, the King Rat is this, you know, the guy about this guy who becomes, you know, this leader of rats. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is a retelling of the Pied Piper story. Only he doesn't lead children out of Hamelin.
Which really, coincidentally, I just got the Disney Plus channel. And took down my Hulu. And the first thing I watched on there was a Disney cartoon from the 40s called The Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Oh, wow. I wonder if I've seen that. That's how I know the story. I don't think I've ever read a version of it. I think I just know it must be the Disney version.
And I forget. I always had forgotten that the reason he seeks his revenge is because they promised to pay him and then they don't pay him.
Exactly.
The town.
That's right.
But in the cartoon, the kids go to a better place.
Oh, well.
Meaning heaven.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. That's how they get you.
But anyhow, what do we need to say? We're assuming people know what this book's about, but I don't
know. Yeah, we don't. I mean, we can do a quick little run through here. Our narrator, the Rat Man, is working at this firm that used to be owned by his father. It's been... But he's just being kept there as sort of a functionary, being underpaid, kind of abused by the boss, a person who...
Who used to be just a...
The underling.
Yeah, an underling who bought the company after the dad died.
Yeah, and he's lives in this extravagant house that his...
With dad his bitch used, of a mother.
Yeah, which his dad used to be able to afford, but now they're living in poverty, just keeping the house. Not right. Keeping it up, just keeping it.
His mother sends him out to kill the rats.
Yeah, kill some
that
rats.
I forget where they are.
They're in a rockery.
They're a rockery.
A rock sculpture garden thing, which I had to look up.
And he wants to kill them, and then his heart.
Yeah, he relents.
He relents, and then he begins to have relationships.
Yeah, with this little troop of rats, and one of the little ones that gets born is this rat that has
Highly intelligent.
Highly intelligent. Fur, it has a furry tail, because most rats have naked tails, scaly tails. And he names it Socrates and starts to train it. And then Socrates quickly becomes his lieutenant, training other rats. And he gets this army of rats.
And they have two rats, and then they have two rats, and so on and so on.
Yeah, and so the story just kind of goes on like this. The mother dies, and he... Brings the rats into the house. Starts trying to solve problems using his rats, and he
stealing money,
scaring people, food, slashing people's tires that he doesn't like.
Revenge on his boss.
Things come to a head one day when he takes his two favorite rats in, Socrates and this other rat who is, if anything, more intelligent than Socrates.
And it's not really his favorite rat. Yeah. That rat is.
Highly useful,
very intelligent, and also a little pushy. Yeah. It's a bossy rat.
It's Ben, and
bossy Ben,
and
he doesn't trust Ben.
He doesn't. No, and Socrates gets caught in the ladies' room, and the boss Jones,
because he's bringing the rats to Ben and Socrates to work.
Ill-advisedly, and Jones kills Socrates, and so this snaps something in our narrator, who vows revenge. Meantime, but he's, you know, which is best served cold, so he bides his time, and
he's starting to get sick of the rats at this point, because now he has a wife.
Well, he doesn't have a wife yet. He has a girlfriend.
But they get married.
And on page 182 of 184 pages, like on the third last page of the book.
But he starts to get sick of the rats.
Yeah, the
rat life.
Yeah, he gets sick of life. Well, especially after Socrates dies.
He's brokenhearted,
and Ben is beyond his control, and he starts to get a little freaked out about what he started.
Yes, it's a Frankenstein story.
Absolutely. So things come to a head at the very end. He pulls off a number of heists. It becomes this.
He wears a rat. Like mask, yes. Like a helmet, like a
mask, yeah. And it gets into the newspapers, and he enjoys reading about himself. And he finally, he pulls off a number of heists to sort of supplement his income, so he can, live a decent life. And then at the very end, he comes into some money through inheritance,
his uncle,
and then he finally picks the day in which he's going to get his revenge on Jones. He's going to kill Jones. And he does so using the rats. And even as it's happening, as these rats are literally tearing all of the flesh off of Jones.
He's regretting it.
And so he says, this is my opportunity. My entire troop of rats is here at the office, many miles away from home. I can just leave without them.
Yeah.
And they won't come back.
Dump the rats.
And so he does that, and he goes back home. And the only rats that are there are nursing mothers and things like that. And he takes them. He kills them all.
He drowns him,
and then he proposes to the girl, and they set a date, and they get they're gonna making plans for the wedding, and he decides that he's gonna renew the entire house. This is Victorian shambles.
It gives her £1,000.
£2,000.
Only £1,000, but she gave her £2,000.
Exactly, and so they sell all the old Victorian furniture and outfit the new house, and it's nice and clean. He goes through and he cleans out all the rat dirt, and disinfects the whole thing, and it's clean, and it's got this new home that's going to be ready to welcome him and his wife. And then his wife leaves town to go visit some friends, and the rats show up.
Dun, dun, dun. And Ben is like, he has like a toothpick in his mouth. Dumped us, eh?
Hey.
We found ya. See? You're gonna pay, eh?
And this is one of these books that ends without punctuation, because clearly the narrator dies in the middle of a sentence.
Right.
Yeah.
And the conceit is somebody found these notebooks.
Yes. He was going to destroy them, but instead what has happened clearly is that in the inquest and search of the house after his death, they found his notebooks and the rat mask, which he'd been meaning to get rid of. And they've tied it all together, and they know who the rat man was, what he did, and how he did it. Correct. That's the story.
All right. So what sticks out?
What sticks out to me
from when you read it?
I thought this was a really well written and paced story.
So you said in the beginning that you read the first few pages and you were like, ugh. God.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it about the... Because I didn't have that experience.
You didn't? Interesting. No. Well, it might have been entirely just me and where I was at.
In your personal life.
My personal life, where I was, what else I was reading and stuff like that. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to read this now. This is not what I want to read right now. And so I read like, I don't know, 10, 15 pages and then let it sit for a week and a half. And then I picked it up again and, backed up a couple of pages, and I picked it up again, read, and it hooked me. And then I was just like, boom. Not quite as boom as you were, because I was literally finishing it as you were walking up the stairs here this evening.
Right.
But no, it was good. The pacing was
brisk.
Was brisk. But not a lot happens in this book, but it still feels like it has velocity.
Well, there's this. I mean, it's almost like the scene in Pretty Woman where they do the montage of her getting new clothes.
Uh-huh.
You really get a lot of it spent on, him figuring out how to train these rats.
Right.
And I found that interesting.
I know.
And then the other half was sort of dealing with his mother and dealing with the boss and the constant humiliation.
Constant humiliations, yeah.
And, it's sort of the precursor to, the same idea of going postal in a way. I mean, he had just been humiliated so much by this arrogant fuck that he just cracked in a way.
Yeah.
And he, so I found the whole thing, the pacing was, there was a lot of time spent on showing how he trained the rats, but then he stopped, the author stopped doing,
I mean,
it ends and then you go to something else and then not a lot does happen, but nothing that feels horrible.
No.
Until Ben shows up. And then that's when I probably felt the most creeped out.
Yeah.
With them talking, the author talking about Ben.
Yeah.
And you're like, and he's menacing. You're like, oh, this is not, this is going to go pear-shaped, as they say in Great Britain.
Yes.
Tits
up.
I already knew what was going to happen, but, being just in the thrall of the book, you're like, oh, yeah, Ben's not good.
Yeah. This the shape of this story, this just occurred to me, is a story of a scientific singularity where you are working on building something. That can learn. You're teaching something to learn. And at a certain point, it surpasses your ability to control how it learns.
Right. It's like AI, or it's like AI. The tapeworms from the last book, or
absolutely.
Or Frankenstein. Absolutely. Or,
yeah, Frankenstein's another singularity.
Frankenstein's really probably the first one, right?
It
where
is.
Your creation.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe Pandora's box a little bit, where you create this woman and she.
Or Prometheus and Fire.
Well, the fire doesn't in the story that he gets punished, right? But the fire doesn't do anything bad.
Yeah.
In Pandora's box, he creates Pandora, and she's the one, out of her curiosity, opens that box and unleashes the horrors in the world. So that's sort of what happens here. They create something is created that unleashes horrors.
Yeah. Yeah.
And probably Frankenstein was. Modern.
Yeah. In so many, you remember what the subtitle of Frankenstein was, is a modern Prometheus.
Right.
In the sense that you're stealing something from the gods that the gods do not want you to take.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it only comes back on Prometheus because he gets punished by the gods.
Sure.
I suppose you could say Frankenstein gets punished by his own creation, not by the gods, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He thinks he's God.
Yeah.
Well, Prometheus was a god, so. Yeah. But regardless, it's like, because it starts off great, and then it turns sour.
Yeah, the whole thing, the part that made me roll my eyes briefly, and then I no longer roll my eyes because it kind of makes sense of how and why he did it, was when it becomes pretty clear that Ben can read. Ben has learned to read.
He has lost control of these beings, which actually he never had control of.
He never had control of them. No, there. No. There's a there's this whole movement in academia these days about sort of tearing down the mental, like the categorical barriers between humans and animals.
Right.
This is an early version of one of these kinds of arguments about, you know, animals. We are animals. We are more animal-like than we like to think that we are.
Yes.
But animals are also more human than we like to think they are.
Right. Well, if anything, the Planet of the Apes taught us, especially the third movie, is
for sure.
If anything,
for sure. You know, I took notes through all of those movies.
Well, yes, we're more alike than different.
That's so true.
Well, even our DNA is.
Yeah.
I mean, we have shared a lot of DNA with a banana. So, I mean, we all came from the same, like, puddle of slime, pretty much. It all came from that.
Pretty much.
Right?
Puddles of slime.
Have you listened to that? There's a podcast, Radio Lab, and they do a whole thing about the dolphin studies in the 70s and how they were giving LSD to the dolphins. And this one woman was trying to train a dolphin named Peter how to talk.
Yeah.
And he kind of could talk.
Yeah, a little bit.
But then she kind of had sex with them.
Yeah. Where was I? I don't listen to that podcast, but that came up recently somewhere that I encountered, and it was...
Oh. I think a book just came out about it.
It was in a book I just edited.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We're doing at my place of employ. We're doing a book called Animal Revolution. And it's all about understanding how when animals act out in ways that fuck up people's plans.
Planet of the Apes.
That's animal revolution that we just haven't learned how to understand yet.
Yeah. And that whole experiment showed that there is a shared something.
Yeah.
And that it's arrogant to think that these creatures don't have feelings or...
Absolutely.
We still eat them and will. But
they're so tasty.
Still have to think about it a little bit. Like,
yes, yeah, you do have to. There are other ways to eat animals than Western humans do. There's ways to do it with care and reverence and management.
But to be fair, there are some other countries that. Are not very good to their dogs and don't treat them with
or their whales
management or their whales or their
absolutely
right or their belugas
so minks.
So anyhow that of course it's kind of beyond it's not realistic but it has a sense of realism the emotional part of it and
no, I mean...
And this guy is very lonely. This character is very lonely. And he gets this companionship
with
Socrates, especially.
Yeah.
Feels...
When Socrates dies in this book, you know, it's...
It's awful.
It's awful. The movie version is worse.
I don't remember.
I remember that quite well. As a little kid, I was like, I was watching this movie. You know, I was eight or 9 years old when I saw this. And... I'm watching this and I thought, this guy's awesome. He's training this army of rats. How cool would that be?
An army of rats.
and it's like he's got this rat pet that like can understand what he says and does what he says. That's fantastic. He treats him like a pet, like this dog that's sitting next to me.
Doggy.
So when he gets clubbed to death by the boss, and it's heartbreaking.
Because it's kind of like his last hold on a connection.
Yeah.
Even though there's a connection happening with that girl, he doesn't have the same.
Yeah.
No. He doesn't have that same warmth that he does with the rat.
No. Exactly. There's that leads me into something I wanted to talk about in this book, is the I think this is intentional in the author's case, but it may not be because this is 1968. The pervasive and casual misogyny throughout.
Oh yeah.
Oh, it's just so, it's not even, it's so disheartening simply because it seems so casual. It doesn't seem, he's not even aware.
Those were the times.
Those were the times.
You have to live with it. Those were the times.
And it's grim, but.
I mean, watch a 007 movie.
Oh my God. Yes. Oh my God. Right? Yeah, for sure. Or just listen to stage banter of the Rat Pack.
Right.
Talking about
the broads.
Anyway, this is firmly clued into that, plugged into that. But it seems even more egregious when you see how much he cares about some of his rats. How fucked up his value system is.
Well, what happens in the book, I think, is that when he's about to drown the mother rats and her babies,
mm-hmm.
he actually pays attention. And when he pays attention, that's when he gets a connection.
Yes.
So I'm guessing, like, really, he's just been sort of drifting through life, not really paying attention.
Yeah.
Because when you live with a mother like that, you probably have to sort of shut off a little bit.
Yes. Yeah.
And so he's kind of disconnected. And that's when he starts. And, you know, I think when he starts paying attention to the rats, that's why he's able to pay attention to this woman at work. Because he starts to pay.
That's awesome. It's like the rats teach him how to, like, become
more human.
More human. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
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 Anyway. Well, dogs will do that. And
dogs
horses
will absolutely do that.
Horses do that.
Yep.
So, anyhow, that might not be true, but that's what I observed. And yeah.
That's our story. We're going to stick to it until we hit stop.
So, was there anything scare you or creep you out? I mean, for me, it was the Ben showing up. And when Ben showed up in the bed and just started pissing wherever he wanted.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ben's persistently showing up in the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when he hits Ben with the metal stick and Ben, like, says, okay, fine. But I will fucking remember
I'm
this.
I'm biding my time. He writes it down in his rat diary.
His rat diary. Well, he does the same thing that the narrator does when Jones kills Socrates. Is like, okay, you fucker, I will remember. I will be back. And then backs off.
Right.
And it's like lets him feel safe.
Right. Right. I think that more so than even the. I mean, we really don't. It really comes to a climax very quickly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the ending's just like, okay, it's over.
Yeah, boom.
And I never really, I didn't have any feeling about that one way or the other.
The ending?
The ending. It just sort of happened very quickly, and it's sort of like,
well, by the,
it's
by,
what has to happen.
Yeah, by the end, he had so morally compromised himself, I just thought, you know, he cannot get away with this. It would be a much more cynical book if he got away with it. And I don't think he's that cynical.
I think if the book was written now, that's what would happen.
Yeah.
He'd get away with it.
Because we're way more cynical.
He, I was just glad that they didn't tear the girlfriend apart.
Yeah, I was trying to remember.
I feel like in the movie it did, but.
It might have already.
I think more people died in the movie, it seems like.
Yeah, I do not remember. I remember the tires, bursting the tires scene. I remember the rats jumping all over Ernest Borgnine and streaks of blood on his clothes and face. And then I don't remember what happens after that. I mean, and so, you know, the movie was remade then in the 90s, early 2000s.
I think of the early 2000s.
Yeah, with Crispin Glover playing Willard. And I remember that being, that was just very arch. It was like, you know, we're making this movie for people who are nostalgic about the old movie. And we're even going to have a scene in which the rats kill a cat, and we're going to play the entirety of Michael Jackson's Ben. The whole thing. From the very beginning to the very end.
I mean, I like Crispin Glover, and he's weird, but he was kind of over the top.
Yeah. Did you see the movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
I barely remember it, too.
I just remember the cat scene.
Okay. And, yeah. And even the death of Jones was pretty
That was pretty gruesome.
It was I don't want to say it dragged down, but he stretched that out. Yeah. Because it was the big moment.
It was the big moment. And he's like, you know, for 1968, I think that kind of gore writing, and it was pretty gory.
Yeah.
It was kind of
splatterpunky in a way.
It was. I mean, when they find him, all that's left is his skull with just a patch of his hair left. His eyes have been
everything else is gone.
Really grim. Oh, not great.
Not great at all.
Poor Jones.
Well, so that's a good segue.
Yes, absolutely.
Skulls and...
Yeah,
because
we need to know how to handle rats. So
right.
On that subject.
I think it's cocktail time.
It is.
Well, here we are drinking our cocktail, our delightful, simple cocktail.
So simple. What's in it? Well, we'll just say what it is. You can just tell us what's in it.
I'll tell you what's in it, and then you can say what it is.
All right.
So you take a shaker, as you are to do, put in some ice, put in a little vermouth, not a lot. Put in some good gin, and then put in, very specifically, Cornichon
brine. Like a tablespoon, I think.
Like a tablespoon.
If you can get some of those like mustard seeds floating around in there, that'd be good too.
For sure.
Yeah.
That's what we did here.
Yeah.
And then shake it up, pour it into the your martini glass, put a Cornichon in the glass.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you've got...
Rat poison.
And it does taste like rat poison.
I know.
It's an acquired. It's not bad. It's just different.
Yeah, it makes me want to go back to my nest and die.
I'm going to leave my rat dirt on the floor.
Absolutely. First leave the rat dirt and then crawl back to your nest and die.
I thought that was the funniest. I had never heard it called rat dirt before.
Really?
Leaving their dirt around.
Yeah.
It's like, that's such a euphemism. Anyhow, there's no rat dirt in this.
No.
Because the rats are all dead.
They're all dead.
After they drink this. So here it is, rat poison.
Chin chin.
All right. Well, as we often do after a cocktail, let's scamper and fall down the stairs into the basement.
Let's climb steep stairs. All right.
Hey, we're in the basement and we're all in one piece.
More or less.
You bumped your head on something.
I know. It wasn't there.
That it was on the floor. Yeah. You and your handstands down the stairs.
I do what I do.
So, I do me.
I do me.
Dance like nobody's looking. What are we reading?
Well, should we read that book that we were discussing before? Let me go grab it.
It is a book that Mike is very pleased with. That he found an original version in paperback.
Yeah. It's a novel from the 80s.
You can hear it crinkle.
Yeah. Well, it's because I'm taking it out of its protective plastic wrapper.
Nerd.
It was published in 1990.
Oh, it's not that old.
No, but it's in the middle of the horror boom.
Yeah.
But it is a book called Nightblood by T. Chris Martindale. Which has been re-released with Ballancourt Books as part of their Paperbacks from Hell series, which I believe we have discussed how much I love that.
Love it.
I just love it. So we're going to read that book.
I wonder if he's related to Wink Martindale.
I wonder.
Who did the game show.
Joker's Wild?
Yeah. Wink.
Joker.
With Wink Martindale. Hey, I have a cousin who's a horror writer. That's the book.
That's the book.
Nightblood.
Nightblood. T. Chris Martindale.
T. Chris Martindale. He has three names. And one of them's an initial.
Pretty much.
What kind of doofus does that?
Because the first name is Talbot. Tiddlywink.
I thought it was Tattletale.
Terrence.
Well, that's the book.
All right.
Go and get it on the Amazon something or other.
Get it on your Kindle, get the paperbacks from Hell version, or do it like I did and spend the big bucks and get a crappy old paperback version.
For thousands of dollars. You have to go on Joker's Wild to get the money to buy
Absolutely.
That book. All right. Let's get out of the basement.
Please.
Don't fall. Hey, we're out of the basement.
All right. Good.
So, anything else about...
Ratman's Notebooks.
Ratman's Notebooks.
One of the things I enjoy when I was reading this book, I was reading a little bit about the author, Stephen Gilbert, who's that wasn't his real name apparently, but
No, that's Stephen Gilbert. That Stephen Gilbert might be his real name, but there's somebody else who has the same has his name as a pseudonym.
Oh, I got you. Yeah, I got you. Okay, yeah, yeah. So this Stephen Gilbert,
he didn't write a lot.
Yeah, he when he published his book, this is his last published book.
Oh.
So he was, you know, at the near the end of his career at this point, and he had published a number of books before that. He had moved in these literary circles with people, include like he was like on, you know, first name basis, like going to parties with E.M. Forrester.
Hey, E.M. Or did you just call him E?
Yeah, and hey. C.S. and C.S. Lewis.
Hey, C.
Like, and he probably met J.R.R. Tolkien. Hey, John Ronald Ruald. And he had this complicated relationship with an older writer who wrote some books about Stephen.
Oh.
Which Valancourt also publishes, not in their horror line, but in their gay literature line.
Oh.
But Stephen Gilbert...
So Stephen Gilbert was mad that he wrote those books?
I think they did not end up friends at the end.
Oh.
But, you know, Stephen Gilbert...
I'm not 5 inches. How dare you?
How dare you? Anyway, I like to think of Stephen Gilbert. He had middling success with his earlier novels, but he had a freaking huge bestseller, and then he got, you know, Hollywood property rights.
Right. This.
So I like to think that he just sort of, like, you know, cashed his checks and, you know.
But he also did other things. I mean, he was involved in other things in his life.
Oh, yeah.
He worked for... Something with Northern Ireland.
And... Yeah, he was very involved in leftist political work and some other things. I can't remember what.
Yeah, but he had another life.
A whole other life, and he had family, a bunch of kids, and he lived. He died in 2010.
So he was kind of old.
His late 90s.
Oh, good for him.
His late 90s. I like to think that his those last 40 years, he was just, you know, living comfortably in obscurity.
I think he also wrote scripts, I think. And didn't he do...
Possibly. Or maybe that's the guy who stole his name.
Or set dressing or something. Or...
Yeah. But he was... he lived this full literary, like, tweedy life. Sort of launched... helped launch the horror boom in the 70s and 80s. And just cashed the checks after that and...
Yeah, I'm sure there weren't. There probably wasn't tons of checks after a while, right?
No, I'm sure not. But, you know, the house is paid for. The kids are out. Kids are out of college. Right. It's all you need.
It's all you need.
Yeah, go on the dole. that's about all I have on the Ratman Knows books. I'm glad we read it.
Yeah, I'm glad we read it too. I don't know if I would call it horror, but I think it's horror-ish. I think it's in the neighborhood. I think it is.
It's as much horror as Jaws is, or, you know.
It's in that realm.
Yeah, the marauding bands of animals rising up. That's if that's horror, then this is horror.
Right. It's kind of that line between horror and science fiction. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Good.
Enjoyable book. Glad we read it. Next time we'll read something different.
We are going to be reading something different because it's a totally different book.
That's how we do.
Written by somebody different.
With different words.
With different
words. And everything. All right.
You're right. That's how we do. All right. So what do we do with this sucker?
I think we should take it out to the rockery.
Mm-hmm. Fill up the moat with water.
Fill up the moat with water.
Let it figure its own way out.
And we'll decide if we're going to drop a little bridge for it to escape or not.
All right, good. That sounds good. All right, bye.
Bye. Sweat beads on his forehead.
in the crisp autumn air. All the ladies, they had gathered. Old Gus knew his time was near. Gus was waiting in a gold room with a fancy chandelier. All the ladies dripped with diamonds. Smoke rose from a table in the rear. The bar was made of cold, cold stone. Behind it stood a foreign man. All the liquor had been drunk up by those monkeys in the band. Dressing black.